Accession number 7310, roll number 1.
Cleave, tape one. Colonel Cleave, could I ask you something about your early life before you joined the
Indeed.
Army? What sort of family did you come from?
Well, I came from a very good old family, which we think came over in the Saxon invasion. And we have a pedigree which goes right back to Queen Elizabeth I, and a few connecting links beyond that. Shows that we lived in the West Country, because there are lots of Cleave Hills. There's Cleave Hills and Cleave Abbey and Bishop's Cleave and all kinds of Cleaves like that. And the Powys family were a branch of the Cleaves, because the name Clive was original Cliff, Clive and Cleave. That was the how they were pronounced and spelt in various ways, but it became established as Cleave in the time of Queen Elizabeth. And then it so happened that in more recent generations, it became the custom in the family for all fit males to go into either the army or the navy as a tradition. My brother's eyes weren't quite good enough for that, so he couldn't go, and I went automatically. There's no question about my future from the day I was born.
Could you tell me a little of your education?
And then I was educated at Rokeby, a local prep school which is still going here in Wimbledon. And then my parents decided that I ought to be detached and learn a little bit more about mixing with people, because we were a very close family, embedded in music. And so they sent me to a boarding school, and because they were very firm evangelical Christians, they chose Dean Close School because it was evangelically oriented. And then I was a boarder, and I learnt to mix with other people, made a lot of very good friends, nearly all of whom were killed in World War I. And after World War I, I felt distinctly alone, because all my friends had gone, musical and friends in other ways. So it was very sad. On the other hand, I've never regretted my education. I think it was a great privilege to have been at a very good preparatory school and having some amusing times, and my education at a boarding school, especially like Dean Close, which is still going strong and is a wonderful school still.
Did you belong to the OTC at school?
I did. I belonged to the OTC at the school. Didn't do very well, because I was rather a weak individual at that time, and I wasn't always able to assert myself. But I was promoted to Lance Corporal, and whereas others got much higher than that, and I passed my Certificate A, which was then, and that did me in good stead when I presented myself to go to the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich.
And when did you present yourself to the Royal Military Academy?
And then I left school at the age of 1912, and I could not pass my exams into the academy, for the simple reason that my history was one of the subjects, and I was absolutely abominable at history, and so much so that I always got the most I ever got at an exam in history at any school was 5 out of 100. And my parents were in despair, because I twice took the entrance to Woolwich and failed because of my history. Then my mother, who was extremely artistic and a brilliant pianist, and I got on very well with, and my father. They were wonderful parents. He's on a brainwave, and she knew that all Clees have a terrific sense of humour, so she presented me with Heath Robinson's Monarchs of Merry England, which is a history in rhyme of, I've still got it here, of English history, and illustrated most amusingly. I learned that by heart, and at my final entry exam, because I was getting beyond the age limit, I passed with 50 out of 100 and got into the shop very low down because of my low marks in that and a bunch of other things. But I did well, I think, in physics and others. And in my first term, I went up 27 places, and I think I would have gone up a good many more places later on. And I did pass into the shop eventually in the autumn of 1913, and my first time at the shop began in January 1914. By the shop I mean the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich, which trained for Royal Engineers. The first 15 were always taken for Royal Engineers, and the Nitwits below the number 15 to down to 75 went into the Royal Artillery. Not always Nitwits, because some of them went in by choice because they wanted the fun and games of being in the Royal Artillery. Anyway, I had to go into the Royal Artillery, and after a long discussion with my father, we decided that I should go into the Royal Garrison Artillery, because at that time the field artillery and horse artillery especially had to be given an allowance, a private allowance, as the pay was nowhere near enough for the standard of living with their horses and their polo and their hunting and all the rest of it. And my father started my career with a cheque for £10 to open my banking account. He said, "I'm awfully sorry, old boy, but that's all I can possibly give you. And after that, there can't possibly be an allowance. You'll have to live on your pay," which I did. And all the time I was in the army, I lived on army pay solely.
Can you remember what that was, your army pay?
I can't quite remember the army pay. I know that I accumulated quite a nice little sum during World War One, because naturally we didn't spend it very much. And that helped me a great deal in a few special ways, like getting a first-class tailor to do my uniform and that sort of thing. After that, I had to settle down. I do remember that in 1931 or two, my pay, monthly pay, came to £30. Of that, about £12 went to my mess bill, about £7 or £8, I think, in the club bill, because we all had to join the local club, and a few other special expenses. And I only really had a few pounds in my pocket upon which to live. And when I decided I must start motoring, I had £10 to spend, and I looked round for a car, couldn't find one. And then I suddenly went to a farmer for some reason and saw an old bulldozed Morris Minor propping up a little shed which had fallen down on top of it. So I said, "Oh, you don't want that, do you?" "Oh, no," he said, "I'd be glad to get rid of it." "For how much?" I said. He said, £10. So I said, "All right, I've got £10, and that's all I had in my pocket, and I gave it to him. And to my utter surprise, found that the car started. So then I drove it back, and with the aid of the military artificers, etc., which was very naughty, we got it going, and that became my first car. That was all on £30 a month. We got up to the...
Yes. What were you... what was your position when war broke out in 1914?
In 1914, I was still a cadet at Woolwich, and I was recalled on the outbreak of war from home leave, and We were told we were to be commissioned in 2 months' time, whereas the normal course was a 2-year course, and we'd only been there for 2 terms. So the program was terrific. And in any case, we only had a quarter of an hour each day to change from a riding kit into a full dress or whatever it was, and we had to be spotlessly clean on parade. And all day long that went on, and sometimes we changed uniforms 7 times during the day, and that's the only way we could get through the program.
Were you doing much riding in the artillery then?
Well, I'd never ridden a horse before, because, curious enough, when we were children in Ceylon, where my father was stationed building the forts in Colombo, they had a bullock cart, and they took the bullock out of the cart and put me on the top of it. They thought it would be rather a good introduction to riding. And the bullock got a fright, and I fell off, and the servants caught me just in time, and I yelled with fright, and that put me completely off riding. My cousins were all brilliant horsemen and did extremely well, but not me. And when I couldn't ride, my father knew I would have to at the shop, so he sent me to a lifeguards and a chap at, whom he knew of at Knightsbridge Barracks, and he put me on his most comfortable horse with its wonderful sheepskin saddle, covered saddle. And I thought, oh, this is most comfortable. And he's awfully kind, and he took me all round the riding school for about a year. And then I really began to feel at home in a saddle, and so I managed to do all the physical jerks and riding tricks we had to do down in the stables at Woolwich. And I passed out on riding, and that was adequate. But I never rode again until I realized that I should have to eventually. And then when I got to Longmoor, where I bought the Morris Cowley in 1929 or 30, the other said, "Now you've got to learn polo." So I said, "I don't mind, I'll learn polo." I had no idea how to do polo, so I got my charger, Ladybird, and I had never been used for polo before, and I used to train it by putting a polo ball on the ground, walk it up to it, and then swing my polo stick near its eye, gradually nearer its eye, till it got accustomed to it. Then that way I was learning myself how to wield a stick. And then we used to play polo at Borden, and Lord Cowdrey used to come over to help us. And he was awfully kind to me. He saw I was an ignoramus, and he used to ride with me and say, "Now you do this, you do that, now you ride off that other man like this," and he showed me how. And then occasionally the others were very kind and said, "Now," and they rode each other off while I was free to shoot a girl, and I was thrilled. So in that way I began to hunt and play polo, which was very central when the regiment was amalgamated and the Royal Garrison Artillery, which I was in, was merged with the Royal Field Artillery, and there were only the two divisions then, the Royal Horse Artillery, which was a swanky one, and the remainder, which was the Royal Artillery.
Could you tell me what other training you had at this period in your life, when war was imminent?
Yes, well, after World War One, the question was, how was I to specialise in the army? And we had a long discussion, my father and I, and some great friends of ours, military friends of ours who lived in Wimbledon. And this friend who was on the staff during the war said, oh, he ought to go to the staff college. And that's the only way really to get on. And I said, no, I'm not going to the staff college. I hate the staff. And I'm sorry to say that was the feeling that left me at the end of World War One, because I suffered mercilessly from some most terrible staff blunders and immobility. Anyway, that was that. So the next alternative was to go into gunnery. Oh, I said, I love gunnery, I'll go into that. Because I had learnt my gunnery a great deal on the Somme and all like that, and we got a terrific reputation on the Somme for being the most accurate battery on that particular section of the front. And generals used to come round and say, we were the only battery that he would trust to shoot close shoots. The close shoot was one which was very near our own front line on Minnewerfers and things like that. And he stopped all other shooting while we did our shooting on a particular close target. And he wasn't the only general. Another general took over from him and treated us in the same way. So I learnt a lot of gunnery. And my major at that time was an ex-instructor in gunnery himself. So with great joy, I was sent on a gunnery staff course at Shoeburyness. But that wasn't the first thing. The first thing was they thought I should be a scientific gunner, so I sent on the advanced class, which is now the Military College of Science. And it was rather amusing because in my first year there, we had to learn how to how to design guns and all kinds of complicated things like that, all the chemicals of explosives and what have you. And on one occasion we were teamed up three at a time in the laboratories and we had to make some nitrocellulose, soaking cotton in nitroglycerine. And the final stage of that was to boil it in a gas oven and wash it 12 times before it was safe to put out. So we made a joke of the whole thing. Oh, we said, now it's your turn to wash it. And washing took quite a long time. Then it was my turn and so on. And we were supposed to do it 12 times. And the next morning, they all came back to find the laboratory blown up. And it was traced to our oven. And then on the court of inquiry, it was found out that hadn't organized it well enough. It was only washed three times and not 12, and that was the reason. So I got the sack. So did the other two, but they did very well in other ways. And after that, it was decided the gunnery staff course, and I went on the gunnery staff course, enjoyed it immensely, and did very well indeed. And got my qualification as an instructor in gunnery, and as such I was sent straight out to Aden where they had the appointment and filled the appointment of an instructor in gunnery in Aden. That was my first important appointment in teaching gunnery, and I think teaching gunnery, which I did a great deal of, has been a great help to me in teaching music, because I've learnt how to convey my own knowledge to other people of all ages, and I have no difficulty now whatsoever in doing it.
What date would that have been when you were sent out to Aden to teach gunnery?
What age?
Yes, what date would it have been?
Oh, date. I was sent out to Aden in 1924.
Oh, I see. Yes, that would have been after the war.
After the war.
Yes.
Having passed my gunnery staff course and all like that before that.
Yes, I see. If I could go back now to the beginning of the war,
yes.
What were you, what was your rank and your position then, before you actually were sent to the front?
Oh, well, I began the war as a second lieutenant. I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in November 17th, 1914. And I was only a second lieutenant for a year and got promoted to lieutenant. And then a year later, I was promoted acting captain. And in 1917, which is quite a separate story about the railway guns, I was still a captain and promoted to acting major in order in November 1917 in order to take charge of the two biggest guns we've ever manned in the Royal Artillery, the 14-inch railway guns, the famous HMG Bosch Buster, and the second one was HMG Scene Shifter, both names given by the men. And they came out of the turrets when the Chilean battleship Cochrane up in Vickers Works in Newcastle was being converted into HMS Eagle One and offered to the army, and they were screaming for heavier guns in France to help destroy the Hindenburg line, and this was just the thing. And I had been on a gunnery battery commander's course at Lark Hill, the School of Artillery, and apparently did so well that I was selected by AG6 for this very special job of taking over these guns, watching them being built, helping in the design, and training the personnel to man them right from the very beginning, because nobody knew anything about how they would operate or fire.
Ah, well, I must ask you a lot about that when we come to the, the latter part of your experience. Mm. But if I could now go back to the war, when war broke out, can you remember how you felt as a young soldier?
Oh, yes, I don't think it concerned me very much. I felt rather happy to feel that I was going to have an important job to do. I think that's what it really was. And with alacrity, I went back to the... I was home on leave at the time, and I went back to the shop at Woolwich and enjoyed the rest of my training very much. And I was thrilled with being in the army and all the things that happened. And we had a very high, what the army used to call, esprit de corps in whatever battery I happened to be, unfortunately. And we were thrilled when in the autumn of 1915 we had mobilized with the first battery of 8-inch howitzers and were sent out to France. The whole thing was rather exhilarating to me, because after all it was my profession.
Did you have any specific training for the front? Can you remember?
Yes, we did, because we went we had to go to Lydd in Kent to do our shooting practice. And we had, when we mobilized in, do you want the story now about the, when we, I was stationed in Portsmouth as my first station in at the end of 1914, and amusingly spent December the 28th to January the 4th in one of those pillboxes called Fort No Man's Land, which is the one nearest to Ryde, which was a most wonderful experience. And then in March 1915 I was posted on formation to 36 Siege Battery, which was the one which eventually had the first four, was issued with the first four 8-inch Mark I howitzers. Extraordinary things, but really were rather wonderful at Taunton. And with them and Caterpillar tractors, which came over from America, which were only agricultural tractors after all, to draw the guns, we went out to France then.
You say, when you were in the pillbox, no man's land, it was a wonderful experience. Why was that?
Well, because it was such a peculiar thing. There are only three of them in Portsmouth, and this was one of them. And they were a part of the Palmerston defences of Portsmouth. And all the forts around, Portsmouth is circled with forts that were still there, I think, mostly, which were called Palmerston Follies, when he thought it was certain that we were going to be invaded by France. And one of the follies was to build these three pillboxes in the Solent, which are massive things. In some places the walls are, many feet thick, a solid granite, and you'd never believe it, but when you get onto the fort, you realise that the area, the surface area of the, each of those four, of No Man's Land anyway, was about half the size of a football pitch. It was enormous. And it was very interesting because we had to climb up the ramp, the iron ramp which led up, on which the guns were moved up into their positions, because they had no facilities like derricks and things in those days. And we had to, there was huge armour plated doors, and we had to knock on the door and give the password and all like that. And then when I was shown in for the first time, I was amazed at the, do you want this now in detail? Amazed with the sight I saw. First of all, there was a railway line. Now, does that connect with later on? I think it probably does. A railway line in the main gallery going all round in a circle to serve the 12-inch breech-loading rifled guns, which were, of which were about a dozen of them, I think, pointing out of the what you call them, porthole things. And they were very extremely modern. They were the latest guns to have been made, I think, around about 1900, and had never been fired, and never were fired. Anyway, that was the main gallery, and the guns, I think, were on some kind of rail mounting, because they were, I remember seeing one of them was drawn onto the railway line for overhaul, a massive great thing the size of this room. And I was put in charge of them as a second lieutenant, only a few weeks old. And I had great responsibility because we had to, the spiral staircases and engine rooms all over the place. The din of the engines was simply appalling. And it's really interesting because you might wonder where the water came from. And each of the forts had a well into the soil, into the ground underneath the thing, and the water was pumped up there.